You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Elise Hurd. She is a certified coach and mental health practitioner based in Melbourne, Australia, specializing in recovery from religious trauma and cults and high control systems. She combines lived experience with professional training to create safe, judgment-free spaces where individuals can explore their stories and recover from coercive systems. Elise is the co-founder of the Religious Trauma Collective in Australia and New Zealand, an advocate for survivors of coercive cults and high-control groups, and the author of Holy Hell, Saved So Hard, I Needed Therapy. I love that title. So it is my pleasure to have Elise on the show today. Here she is now. I am so happy to have Elise Hurd with me today. She's calling in from another part of our world. That's just very exciting, and I appreciate you getting up early to do this. I would love you to take a moment and introduce yourself to the people listening, and then we'll start our conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It is very early here in Melbourne, Australia, but it's lovely to be able to jump on and have a chat with you. So I'm in Australia, born and raised here. I'm a certified coach and a qualified mental health practitioner. I run my own practice specializing in religious trauma, cult recovery, and coercive control. I'm also one of the co-founders of the Religious Trauma Collective Australia and New Zealand, alongside Sam Sellers and Jane Kennedy that really exists to be able to support survivors, to educate practitioners, and to advocate for systemic change. So that's been really fun to be a part of. My own lived experience, I grew up in fundamentalist evangelicalism my whole life, always in a Pentecostal flavor of church. I was then in leadership within a high-control Pentecostal megachurch in Melbourne, who also exists throughout pretty much most of the world. They have a large space in the US. Within that kind of space, I experienced a lot of cultic grooming, systemic abuse, assault, and then silencing of my story when I disclosed that abuse. Off the back of that and her work, I then authored a book called Holy Hell, Saved So Hard I Needed Therapy. A little bit about my background and what I do now.
I love the expression, saved so hard I needed therapy. Yeah, there are times that things that happen that are so aggressively done that they're traumatizing in their own right. Even in small ways, I think about kids where I see parents are trying to clean their face, licking something and then trying to rub something off their face. And the kids are like, please, please, it's way too hard, way too aggressive. I know you care. Please stop caring so much. There are a lot of times we encroach in other people's space, but also other people's psyches in an attempt to save them that we're harming them or we're alienating them. And it shows, I think, a real disconnection from who is in front of you and also really caring about what's best for them. Because I think a lot of that ferociousness in that moment comes from feeling like you've been tasked with something that God wants you to do. And it comes across with that level of intensity. What do you think about that moment, the saved so hard part of this?
Yeah, it is that really intense belief that you are responsible for other people being saved. And so much of that, as we know, comes from the fear-based theology or understanding. They are trying really hard to do what they think is right and what they think is going to be the most helpful thing for your eternal salvation. And that can be really aggressive, especially when it comes to the indoctrination and conditioning in spaces, particularly high control evangelicalism and in the Pentecostal space, where it is constantly reinforced that your spiritual world is more real than your physical world. And so even if this feels painful or this doesn't feel nice, we believe it's for your spiritual benefit, then the suffering is okay. It can be really aggressive, but you're also told at the same time that that aggression and that control is how you are loved.
It sort of ties in with the phrases that you hear that are disturbing for people outside those realms, like spare the rod, spoil the child. This is how you show love. This is how you keep someone on a good course. But no, not at all. I don't think anyone felt really, truly loved by that, nor did it help them become better people or sort of better in God's eyes. I think it makes people traumatized and scared. I know we'll get into the work that you do and how to define that kind of mental health work that is for spiritual outcomes, for spiritual abuse, because I want people to understand that it is like other mental health professions, but it has this very fine-tuned way of helping people who are dealing with spiritual issues. And to have people know what that distinction is, it's nuanced, but really important. Before we get into that, though, I'd love to hear about your family getting involved in something and growing up in something and what that was like and coming out of it for yourself, making that transition, because I work with a lot of second-gen people who were born and raised, and they are trying to adjust to the world outside, but still carrying a lot of the worries, the self-deprecation, the doubting, all of it, the fears, while needing to make that adjustment. So I'd love to just learn more about you, about your early years and then leaving and what that was like.
It really was my whole world. And I say that carefully, knowing that I did still go to a normal public school, a secular school. I was very much still considered as living in the world. But I always understood from a very early age that my purpose for being in those places was to bring other people to church. Yeah, I remember even always inviting my friends when I had friends. I had a very hard time at primary school and high school. But when I had friends, it was feeling that pressure to be able to bring them to church, to get them saved. So there was a real sense of responsibility that I held from a really early age. Funny enough, it didn't really come from my family. I lived with my parents and I've got one older sister who's 18 months older than me. I never really remember talking about church or about God that much in our family home, but we were going to church multiple times a week. It was a lot of TV shows, music that we couldn't listen to. Also going into my teenage years and really not being able to connect well with my peers because I had no idea what they were watching or listening to. I was the weird kid that kept inviting people to my youth group. I met my husband in high school. He was not from a Christian family. We were friends for a while. Of course, I invited him to church. He came. He ended up becoming a Christian. And then we got engaged and we were engaged just before I finished high school. So I did the good Christian girl thing. I got engaged. I just turned 18 a few months before we got engaged, got married at 19. We had our only daughter at 21. So we were in church the whole time. We had the firm belief that we then needed to raise our daughter in church. And that's when we kind of separated off from my parents and ended up at a different church that changed around us, been taken over a few times. And it was that church that then became the mega church that my husband and I were then involved in for about 15 years. Church was huge. It was our whole life, but a lot of the pressure and what I would look back at now and consider the conditioning and the indoctrination that I went through was from the church, my peers, the leaders, the pastors, not so much from my parents. They were maybe reinforcing it in more subtle ways, but it was really the church that really put that fear of God, which is a horrible term to use, into me. That's when I first made my own personal decision was when I was in children's church at maybe 8 or 9 and the kids pastor had drawn up on a whiteboard heaven and hell and told everyone that if you do not choose today to become a Christian, then you could leave here and die and you will be separated from your parents forever. And so what child would actually feel like that is any kind of choice to make? Who wants to be separated from the people that feel safe? And so that's when I then made the decision that I need to be a Christian and I need to be doing whatever I can to make sure that I'm okay so I don't end up in hell. Because it was also very clear that hell was a place where you were consciously, eternally tormented.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was not like, here's a choice, you're okay, whatever choice you make. There is one right decision. And if you don't make it, there are huge eternal consequences, and not just for you, but for your loved ones, because you're also going to separate you from them.
Incredible. Okay. So disturbing and panic inducing. I mean, to go right for the thing that is going to affect a child the most when they are still dependent on their caregivers, it just sounds awful. And so, what did it mean within that church to be a Christian or to be a good Christian? How was that defined?
It was defined by a certain understanding of the Bible, a certain understanding of leadership and submission, especially for girls and women. There is this strange tension that happens in a lot of Pentecostal churches, which is that it looks on the outside like women are equal. that women can preach, they can take most leadership roles, except you are constantly reinforced that your husband or your father are the ones that are leading you. So you can still only do what they are allowing you to do. And if you step into that leadership role, then you have broken the way that God has set things up. And so while it may look like it's a lot freer for women, if you actually kind of scratch beneath the surface, it's not much different than telling women that you can't lead, you can't speak, whatever it might be. And so it looked like following authority to a T, you needed to be taking the advice of whoever was discipling you. You usually didn't have a choice. For me, when I was in kids' church, it was the kids' leaders. When I was in youth, it was the youth leaders, which was a lot of purity culture, a lot of here's what we can and can't do in order to be a good Christian. Christianity looks like here are the rules. We're telling you that these are the rules that God has set out and that these rules are here to keep you safe and to make sure that you don't go outside of love. It wasn't confusing at the time. It was actually really simple because I was handed a way to understand the world and to feel some kind of sense of certainty within that world. And that didn't unravel until I ended up leaving. It was a lot later that I realized, actually, I wasn't feeling safe at all. I was feeling terrified constantly. And I had a lot of mental health struggles growing up with anxiety and depression.
Which is understandable. Also, it can be through heredity, but it can also be situational and sometimes a little bit of both. And I know there isn't the acceptance of getting treatment for it, having it assessed, having it abated, helped. There isn't really a place to go or the acceptance of going to a place. I'm wondering what you did with it all, with all of the feelings. Do you just sat with them or what was there to do?
Yeah, for a long time, I just sat with them. I really believed that there was something wrong with me, that I wasn't praying enough or I had done something to make God upset with me. The constant concern was if I do something wrong and I get on God's bad side, then I'm going to be punished for that. And so maybe this was a punishment for something. And so then constantly trying to push myself harder when I should just have been trying to take care of how I was feeling was going, well, there must be a reason for this. And it has to be my fault because I'm a horrible, broken sinner. So there's got to be something that I did wrong. And just at that time, there was not that much awareness around mental health as it was. I didn't want to tell anyone because I felt so ashamed that I couldn't just be better. I couldn't just pull myself up by the bootstraps and keep going. And I was very determined to do well academically. So I kept pushing myself to be able to do my work. And then it got to the point where I was beginning to have suicidal thoughts. And that's when I decided to tell all my mom how I was feeling. She was absolutely beautiful. She did everything that she knew to do. And get it at that stage, it was not common knowledge that you take someone to a GP when they're telling you that they feel like that. So I never felt any pressure from her to, you know, just pray it away or to do something different. She would just be with me. I stopped being able to sleep. I had horrible insomnia and she would just sit on my bed every night until I could fall asleep. When I'm trying to tell her that I'd done something wrong, she was just doing her best to fix it. Again, it was the church and my youth leaders at the time that were like, you should just be happy. Just choose to be happy. Choose to live in the joy of the Lord. And so it did end up passing after about 6 months. And then it came back with a vengeance when I was pregnant. So I had pre and postnatal depression. And that's when I decided I can't take care of another little human and myself. And that was the first time that I went to a GP and then started to see a counselor for my mental health. And that made a world of difference.
Right. It's actually quite beautiful hearing about your mom and how she wanted to just be present and to have you know she was there and she cared. And that sometimes What kids of all ages need is that reassurance, the proximity. They might not need to talk all that much. They just need to know that somebody is there. So that's really lovely.
It's absolutely what I needed. I mean, I refused to go to sleep most nights because I had this fear that I was not going to wake up. And again, I was never sure where I was going to end up if I died. And so it was this real kind of intense fight of, I know I need to sleep, but there's this fear that if I go to sleep, I was literally scared that I was going to wake up in time.
On the one hand, sure, I see that people want to motivate people to be quote unquote good, but it is such a cruel thing. Not only do people need to worry about heaven and hell, they need to worry about the not knowing. The not knowing is probably one of the hardest parts, and that you can't guarantee and that you can't feel rest assured that your quote unquote good behavior that day was going to safeguard you at night. When we talk about what causes people to feel anxiety, what causes people to also feel calm and reassured, it usually has to do with anticipation. Can you anticipate? Can you predict? Do you know what's going to be happening? Do you know that, let's say, your parent is going to be there at the end of the day? For kids who deal with parents sometimes being emotional in a way where they don't know if they're going to have someone cruel in their home or someone kind, the not knowing is one of the hardest things. And so here that you were in this limbo. Same thing with people who are told that the world is going to be destroyed. Armageddon is right around the corner. They don't know where they're going to be, but they don't know if anything is going to be. It is such an unfair burden.
Yeah, that was also true for us, was the constant threat of the rapture can happen at any moment and the world will come to an end and then judgment will happen. I talk about that quite a bit in my book. One of my first chapters is how it was my first anxiety disorder, because it was that constant fear of not being able to know that drove me to perfectionism, to never say no if a leader ever asked me to do anything in church, which is all of the stuff that I then had to unravel after the betrayal, but also knowing that I also did harm in similar ways because of that mold injury, of not being able to see what I was doing at the time was harmful. There's a lot to unravel when you come out of that and realize, oh, I think everything that I have done has been based on this fear that I could be tortured for all eternity if I don't get this right.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah. Just life.
Right? Oh, that just seems so relaxing.
So relaxing when you finally get to undo that.
Mm-hmm. Right. I think it's also sometimes helpful, though it's not really offered as a possibility when you're in it. It's really good when you're on the outside to understand why there was this teaching and why they used this fear-based way of trying to teach a lesson, what was driving them to do this, and that it really wasn't necessarily a message for you, but they were under obligation or they were feeling pressured or they needed to do the right thing. However, that was presented to them as the right thing. It's part of a system. I put together this journal that's on Amazon. I looked at a lot of other journals and I thought, well, I just don't want to offer writing prompts. I want there to be some education in it, understanding the why and the how, and not just here, share your feelings, but to, I don't even want to say sneak in because it's really just presented openly. This is why these things can happen, or this is what that technique that was used on you is called and why it worked. So I think it really helps to almost separate you from it being a personal message for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. That was so important for me. And I actually needed to do that. I needed to understand what it was, what the system was, what the tactics were that they used before I could even allow myself to sit with really how it had impacted me on an emotional and a physical level. I needed to be able to understand it. So I was so disconnected from my body anyway, because our body is just evil, that really I only had access to my mind still. And so using my mind to go, what was this? What were they actually doing? And that then gave me the ability to separate that and go, okay, there were absolutely things that happened directly to me that were not okay. But to look at the system as a whole and to have the language for it and the awareness of what it was and how it worked, and how it worked so effectively that it took a lot of the shame off me. It reduced a lot that thought of how did I fall for this? Of going, how could you not fall for this?
I think that's a much better question. How could you not? It's a system that's been so fine-tuned over millennia that you don't realize you're getting into something that is not haphazard at all. Like, figured out what works.
And especially when it's all you've known, but also being part of churches and a flavor of religion that was very much constantly wanting you to recruit. And again, they wouldn't use that word, but always wanting you to be out there recruiting other people. So I also see how other people are not falling for this either. They're being offered belonging and community and a sense of purpose. And who doesn't want that? And that's the thing. They know that.
Right. Then here you are going back to that moment of being pregnant and after, and so burdened by your emotions. I'm really glad that you reached out for help and that you got to experience that being helpful to you in, I think, really fundamental or practical ways so that you could move on. You could enjoy the gift of motherhood if that's something you had wanted to be able to enjoy. And so then what happened after that, after you were able to seek out some therapy for yourself?
Yeah, so I was able to seek out therapy. I was able to get on some really helpful medication. I had a beautiful nurse that just sat with me and my husband in the hospital when I ended up going to the ER because it was my first anxiety attack. And I thought that I was having a heart attack, which is very common. Went to the emergency room. The doctors there were less than helpful because I wasn't having thoughts of harming myself or my baby. I just want to disappear. So they basically said, here's some Valium, go home. But I had a nurse that came in and sat with me and just said, like, what is the hardest thing for you right now? And I said, the hardest thing is the fact that I am the only person that can keep her alive through breastfeeding. And she just said, do you really want to be breastfeeding? Is that something that really matters to you? And I'm like, no, actually, I hate it. I don't like it. It's painful. It's tiring. I love her. She just turned to my husband and said, if she stops breastfeeding, will you do some of the night feeds? And of course, he said, yes, absolutely. That helped a lot. And then I went to the GP, got medication, got a referral to a counselor. And I was feeling like myself again within 6 weeks. And I remember thinking, how would it have been different if I had access to this as a teenager? And that was also my first time really seriously considering that I would like to go into the work of counseling. But then very quickly, the church pulled me back into, no, you are called to leadership. You are called to be a pastor. That may be helpful, but only for this purpose. And again, I was still very much, yeah, whatever the church told me, whatever the pastor says, that must be what God wants for me. So I put that to the side for another 10 years or so.
Okay, wow. I think about this interaction with this nurse, how efficient it was, how you weren't told to pray about it. You weren't judged. It became very much about how do we solve this problem and make it really not a problem. And just asking your husband if he'll do some of the work here. And I'm glad he said yes. And you knew he would, I think. You wouldn't be with him, but also that's lovely. And not trying to talk you into continuing to do it or talking about what's best for a child or bonding or all the guilt things that could come into play in those moments, but really zeroing in on you and what you needed and what flexibility, which you didn't have in the church, but what flexibility was possible there that would still make things okay. I really like that you got to experience that and probably how different that felt.
Yeah, it felt so different because I mean, my daughter's 17 now, so it was a while ago, and it was very much during the time of breastfeeding is the best thing that you should be doing for your child. So to have someone genuinely give me the choice of going, do you want to do this? Because it's okay if you don't, was so practical. But you're right, it felt so different to every other area of my life because I actually had the power to make that decision.
That's fantastic. I'm really glad. Because I think also when you're in a system that decides things for you and tells you what you're supposed to be doing, you can get the unspoken message, you can't be trusted. You're going to make a bad decision. So we need to guide you. And instead, the nurse said, what's best for you? Then you had a medical professional telling you it's going to be okay, whatever you choose, which is lovely.
Yeah. The constant reinforcement from the church was that your leaders are your spiritual covering. And so they actually get more access to what God wants for you than you do because they have been given a responsibility for you. One of the things that I was told when I eventually walked away was essentially you need to be careful because you now don't have spiritual covering. And by that stage, I wanted nothing to do with their spiritual covering, even if that was the thing.
Right. So let's talk about your eventual leaving and how that all happened.
I was on staff at this church. So I had been very involved and as a extremely large church, like we know with other large organizations, you can have pockets of it that feel healthier, feel less controlling. And then you can have pockets of that that are really enforcing those cultic, controlling, totalistic control. And that's essentially what I would say the staff was. If you were on staff, there was a high level of control over almost every area of your life. I had just been really burnt out. I was leading their Bible college. I was the vice principal in Melbourne. I was the only staff member in Melbourne for the college. I was also then now brought into the executive team. I was preaching at multiple services on a Sunday, which was not part of my paid role. So it was a full-time job plus the volunteer work plus COVID. So this was around 2019. So COVID was just hitting. So I reached out for some pastoral care for the first time in my life. And that went horribly wrong. So I experienced grooming and then assault. And then when I went to a pastor that I thought that I could trust, there was just a lot of silencing and a lot of threats. And then COVID hit. And so then I was at home on my own trying to figure out what to do. I went through a 2-year court battle that the church was not behind. I ended up going to the police because I was told that I would lose my job essentially if I did go to the police. So that was my moment of going, they are not going to protect me. They are going to protect themselves. And so at the end of that, I stayed in that church for another 2 years. I was made redundant about 12 months after that. So I was also stuck on staff trying to go through that, being told that I couldn't tell anyone, constantly being blamed, being warned that I was going to have a warning put on my staff file for my behavior. It just got really messy and confusing really quickly. At that point, I was very lucky that a counselor that I decided to go and see, who was a Christian counselor, because I still didn't feel like it was okay to see someone who wasn't. I just happened to walk into the office of a Christian counselor who understood religious trauma, grooming, coercive control. She was a lifesaver. So that was kind of when I first started to really unpack what had happened and that it wasn't my fault and that I didn't have an affair. And all of these little things that the church were constantly trying to say, you need to look at yourself. You need to look at what you've done wrong. Take responsibility. And it was just getting really hard because at that point, I was then listening to messages sitting in church on a Sunday and even listening to the lyrics of the songs and realizing how shame-filled they were. Because I was finally starting to connect to my body and how I was feeling. And then I'm sitting in church going, oh, I'm feeling these same things that I felt with my abuser. I'm like, this is really weird. God is sounding a lot like my abuser right now.
Whoa.
It was, you're still bitter. You need to forgive more. You're just in a really bad headspace right now. Had someone come and pray for me in the middle of a service to pray against the spirit of division that I have had in me. It was a couple of years because it's not easy to leave a place that you've been 13 years of your life to that you want to hope will change and will do better. And they just weren't. And so I eventually needed to leave. At that point, I had unraveled a lot, and it was leaving was much more about the fact that I no longer aligned with what they were teaching. And I actually found it really harmful to me as a human being who now believed that I was actually good.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow, my goodness. Okay. To have been assaulted, betrayed in the way that it was dealt with, and then to feel assaulted again in church and hearing God's whatever words or how God was quoted, making you feel the same way, that's really dramatic and really powerful. Here you are understanding too that the control that they were going to be having over you was going to be to try to, I think, reinforce you being at fault, you being to blame, keeping then the status quo that responsibility is misdirected, redirected outward, which is so awful, so confusing also, when you don't have a clear sense of that that's really wrong and that what happened to you should never have happened.
Yes. I tried really hard to be okay there because I knew what I was going to lose as soon as I left because I had people there that, you know, my daughter had grown up with that had been with me through all of my mental health struggles, that I really believed were genuine friends that would love me for me. But I also knew that what was changing for me in terms of my beliefs, it was going to change that because I knew what the worldview that they have and that I was now going to either be someone that was going to corrupt them or I was going to be a project they would need to say, and I was not willing to be that. And so knowing everything that I was going to lose, I just kept coming back to, I don't feel right. I don't feel okay being here. I don't think it's right to cry all the way home driving my car because I've been holding back a panic attack for the last 2 hours, sitting through a service that's telling me that I'm just a horrible human being and that's the way that God allowed me to be born. But also then going, if this is my family, their language is, we are your family now. This is your home. If they're my family, how can I have a NDA and a non-disparagement clause in my staff contract that meant that even if I told the truth, if it made this church look bad, they could sue me? Just looking at the dynamics of that and going, if that was happening within a family unit, would anyone be looking at that and saying, yeah, that's okay? That's okay that your parents have decided that even if they do something horrific, they're not allowed to say anything bad about them. They always have to look good, but you need to take the fall. And so it got to the point where I'm like, even the community that I was trying to hold on to no longer felt safe because there was that constant threat of if you tell the truth, we might just sue you.
Right. You know, it goes into this whole realm that a lot of my clients deal with where they were taught not to share, not to talk, not to tell what happened to them, to keep secrets, to protect the group, to protect a perpetrator. The fact that NDA now can mean non-disparagement is so problematic, because it's all about how you define the truth, as you're saying. A lot of people who are narcissistic also are really afraid of people sharing their truths about their interactions with a narcissist. They will call that person abusive, attacking, slanderous, all the other things, when that person is just saying what is and what was. And so it's the same thing here. You don't get to say, and you don't get to have that heard and honored, and not in that context. You know, in other places, through your book, through talking, through the work that you do, you get to experience that. But in the legal realm, your hands are tied, and that's really unfair.
Yeah, which was why it was such a deeply important moment for me when I did get to share the completeness of my story through the current Victorian parliamentary inquiry into the recruitment methods and impacts of co-ops and fringe groups because of parliamentary privilege. But it's not okay that that's the only way that survivors from this particular place could tell their story, because not everyone gets that opportunity and not everyone feels safe enough with that kind of publicity to share their story. And to the narcissism is very real. For me, I mean, I talk about in my book, God being a narcissist, which was very contentious for me even internally to be able to admit that the version of God that I had been handed, which is the version that says, love me or else. If you don't choose to love me, I'm going to send you to hell. There's no choice in that. There is no informed consent. And so even, again, understanding, wow, like, what have I been handed? And what do I want to set down? And what parts do I want to hold on to?
It's interesting. Being able to feel free to talk about God and how you envision God is, I think, a very powerful thing, that you can have your own relationship, but you can have your own viewpoint. I know that within certain churches, that is not okay. Within, I'm thinking of my religion, within Orthodoxy, that would not necessarily be okay. But as I grew up in a conservative movement, conservative with a big C, not small C, that's just what it's called. It wasn't really conservative in its social leanings and political leanings. But I remember being able to say in a class with my rabbi, it seems like God really had anger management issues. And, you know, and the rabbi's like, yeah, that is an issue. The flood. Well, okay, maybe we could have talked this through.
Yeah, maybe a little bit extreme.
Right. Still. Okay, so here you are coming out into the world, and I want to be able to talk even briefly about what the challenges were there for you. And then we'll talk about your work and also highlighting the Pacific Rim and the issues there with what is needed there that's not available, that needs to be available, and why I in California have so many clients from Australia and New Zealand, because it's hard for them to find resources there. And you being able to talk about what is needed more in that area of the world would be great to finish our talk with, really discussing and covering if you can. But for you, going back to that transition into the world, yes, you had already had some exposure, but what did you notice was a challenge for you?
The challenge for me was the immediate silence. I'm a huge introvert, so silence and being on my own is not a problem. But this was different. This was telling people parts of the truth enough so they knew why I was leaving and why I was not going to be there anymore. At that point, my husband was choosing to stay, which was okay. We were, one of the huge things that I've learned is that recovery can't be coerced. And so he was still there. I was no longer coming. My daughter was kind of in and out trying to figure out what she wanted. But when I left, I heard from maybe two or three people for a couple of months, one a little bit longer. But as soon as my beliefs started shifting, as soon as I started talking more openly and getting into the work that I'm doing now, that community just closed to me. I understand enough of what they would be saying because I was sitting in the leadership meetings when people had left for similar reasons. I knew the narrative that was going to be shared about me that was not going to be true. And so I think sitting with that and really trying to hold that tension of what do I believe is true about myself and how can I separate the things that I don't have control over, which is whatever they're going to say, whatever they can think about me, and how can I create boundaries for myself, which I've never really had boundaries before. Except the boundaries that the church tells me to have with non-Christians because they're not safe, which were not so much boundaries as just outright hating people. Yeah, it was a lot of work with some really good counselors. I had an amazing coach that really supported me in terms of unraveling what I believed and what my spirituality was because I've been so involved in teaching the Bible and teaching theology and doctrine that there was so much that I wanted to figure out. I was still very much in the black and white thinking, like, if I don't believe this, I have to have something else. What do I believe instead? I was not comfortable at that point with not knowing, which I very much am now. I'm very comfortable with saying I have no idea what I believe about God, and I have no desire to go near the Bible. I'm okay with that, but that took a lot of time to sit with. So I think it was the silence, and then it was just how uncomfortable it was to make new friends and to find new communities, which I've found with survivors, I've found with the co-founders of the Religious Trauma Collective. It was just a whole lot of time of going, I feel like I'm living in a completely different world that I've been told was bad and I was going to lose myself. And none of that has come true. It has been the most freeing experience. I say that there's also a lot of kind of emotional upheaval that happens with that. But even the fact that I get to feel that now, I get to feel all of my emotions, I get to be okay with that. And that doesn't mean that I am failing as a human being.
I think people don't realize how difficult it is when you have been raised with the answer to everything, which can keep you emotionally disconnected. Like if someone gets ill, well, that's because of this. And if they die, well, that's... And there's this explanation rather than being able to just emote and sit with the not knowing or sit with the loss. Oh, well, that's a punishment. That's why this person got ill or whatever. So then you just go whistling about your day, like you just moved on. And then suddenly when you don't have that immediate answer, you do find yourself sitting with the emotions and not knowing how to handle them. It's like a muscle you haven't worked out, like you haven't gotten practice with managing emotions. Even just exposing yourself to what's happening in the world and seeing that things are unfair and that things might just happen. I remember growing up hearing actually from my rabbi, he would say that nature doesn't have a conscience. So if the tornado knocks down your home but not your neighbor's, it's not because you did something wrong and they didn't. You're living within nature. It exists sometimes independently of you and your behavior or your belief system. And so to not see that there's a reason, but if you have a reason, then you don't really have to have the feelings. And so just managing that and how heavy that can feel until you learn how to have feelings and how to move through them also.
Yes. Yes. I think that's one of the biggest fears that I'd see people holding when they have not been connected to their emotion is, what if I get stuck in this? What if I can't move through it? So there's a lot of that safety and stability that needs to be built first to go that there is a way to move through it. And that there are ways that even if you're feeling stuck in an emotion, there are ways to be able to regulate that and to continue to allow that to be there without feeling like it's so overwhelming that it's going to undo you.
Mm-hmm. Right. And to know also that this is how most of the people in the world also operate, that they sometimes are overcome with emotion. Sometimes they need help moving through it, but typically they have this sense of, this is just going to take time. I have sort of a toolbox for it. I know I need to reach out for help, or I need to take a bit of a break, or whatever it is, but you've learned to address what your own psyche needs. I'm curious about the counseling that you do and just becoming a counselor, a mental health practitioner and a coach, and the process and how that's been for you, and also how you can help our listeners understand the distinction between counseling and also spiritual counseling and where they crossover, but also where they are divergent.
Yes, I think there's definitely a difference. I have some strong opinions about spiritual counsel, mainly because most of the time what I see here in Australia is spiritual counseling is given by people who are not qualified to do counseling. It's usually pastors or leaders that are just calling themselves a spiritual counselor because they feel like God has given them that permission, that authority. So I was a qualified counsellor before I stepped into the staff role at church, and kind of just put that aside because, you know, there's other things I was told that I needed to be doing. And so when I left, which is like a lot of pastors that I talk to or I work with who are no longer part of a church, a lot of the time they have been groomed for that kind of role from a very young age. So they come out into the world going, what do I do with a theology degree? What do I do in the real world with biblical studies? Because there's not really any jobs out there that you can do, which is also why there's a lot of pastors that feel like they can't leave because they don't know where they're going to find financial stability outside of that role. And so I have a counseling qualification. I thought I would do some study to kind of, it had been a few years since I finished that. And because I had been seeing a counselor and a coach separately, I got something unique from both of them. And so I decided that I would go and do my coaching qualifications. Coming from the kind of environment that I did, which was very high control, cultic, I did a lot of research on where I wanted to do that because there are a lot of qualified coach in 7 days. And so I ended up going to the same institution that the coach that I saw had gone to. And so I did a 12-month course to be a certified coach alongside some trauma-informed training and professional development in the counseling space. And during that time, I was still doing a lot of my own work of going, what do I actually want to do in this space? How can I work here while also potentially being triggered? And so it took a bit of time to get into that space. Also then choosing to run my own business because I am still and potentially think I always will be triggered by any kind of authority structure outside of myself. So it was an amazing workplace. I don't know if I would be able to work for other people. I did for a little bit after I left the church. I actually found that to be quite a good experience, but I had a lot of autonomy in that role. I was working from home. And so eventually I decided I would go full-time into my private practice while also doing a graduate certificate in mental health and currently about 3 months away from finishing my master's in mental health. I've worked with a combination of counseling and coaching for a while. I'm now fully under the coaching banner in terms of my business and mental health practitioner. And I just find that the coaching element, particularly the way that I work with clients, it's not your typical coaching, which a lot of people imagine is I'm going to come in, I'm going to set goals, you're going to hold me accountable. That goes against everything that I want to be doing in this space because I don't want to replicate control. I don't want to be an authority figure in your life telling you what you can and can't do. Also very aware of the power differentials that are held when I sit with a client. And so the coaching element for me is much more about being able to work within the narrative framework. And I love doing parts work. That is the thing that really supported me to connect back with myself. Being able to sit with someone who may not feel comfortable yet going to see someone who has the label of a counselor, but going, maybe I feel comfortable just going to see a coach who just listen and affirm and maybe give some awareness around what might be happening, ask them questions that they can consider. And so it's slow work because it is trust building. It is making sure that they are comfortable to be choosing for themselves. So that's kind of the space that I work in. And then with the Religious Trauma Collective, this is our second year that we've been running in Australia and New Zealand. And we did start this because we saw that there is a huge gap in this part of the world for religious trauma and cult recovery practitioners. So there was kind of a handful that we knew of, but everyone was kind of working out on their own because they weren't quite sure who else was really doing this. How do we even connect? So we've now got a Facebook group with practitioners that work in Australia and New Zealand and a registry on our website. So anyone comes to us, a survivor looking for support, they can go and look through the practitioners that are on our website in Australia and New Zealand, and they can choose. We offer to help guide them in a direction if there's a particular thing that they want help for, and we know that a practitioner has experience in that space. But most of the time, we really like to just point them to the website and go, you have a look through the profiles. You see who fits for you, because we're not a referral service. We just want to have a safe place for people to land where they can either find professional support, they can find a free resource, they can connect with other survivors. We're just starting our first support groups in a couple of weeks.
Great. Support groups are incredible. They have been so meaningful over the years for so many people for so many reasons. I'm now facilitating 4 different support groups for different groupings of people. But people who, I have a general former cult member support group, and also families can jump in, parents and others. They want to hear from people who have left and want to know what was helpful to them and what wasn't. And people who've been abused by their Eastern meditative teachers, people who were instructors at Landmark, and another one for former Scientologists. There's a lot of crossover, but there are a lot of distinctions too. And how it's run and trying to be sensitive to each of their needs, but also each of their traumas. And the need to be able to say, in one of the groups, it's small enough where on purpose so that they can, if there's someone new, they like to reintroduce themselves to a new person and get oriented. And I have to say, I think, or I don't know if I have to say, but I choose to say each time, if I call on you, it's not because you're my favorite. I call on you first. It's not because you said the thing that I really like. And I'm not punishing you if I call on you last. This is really, and sometimes I'll send a screenshot of the order of the names on my screen so people know it. I'm really just following the order on my screen. It really isn't personal. And those are the things that might not occur to someone who hasn't done post-cult work, where there was a hierarchy, where people were punished. You could sometimes sit closer to the leader. It's because you were being rewarded. And if otherwise you were pushed to the back, and it's very hard to come back and regain that space again. You had to prove yourself and you don't accrue points. You have to start all over again. So I think it's fantastic that that's something that's going to be offered to being able to do groups. It's very hard to start something from scratch. I give you a lot of credit for just making it happen. It's just, I'm thinking about it. I'm getting tired thinking about it. It's so much work.
Yeah. Yeah. And the three of us are basically doing it on a volunteer basis. It's just been incredible the amount of people that we have met and connected with that work in this space, that are also out there providing different services and supports for survivors that we can't do. So we came into this going, we cannot be the only ones doing it. And how can we support other people that also feel like they're doing this work on their own? Because there is particularities in Australia and New Zealand that may not be understood in different spaces. But also the three of us, myself and Jane and Sam, have experienced time and time again having clients come to us because they have seen a practitioner who hasn't understood religious trauma or cults. And they have come to us going, this is the first time that someone's actually told me that this makes sense, that I'm not just imagining this. This is actually something really serious, had a deep impact. And so that's why we're also very passionate about providing training and awareness for other practitioners so that they can work well in this space, whether they've got lived experience or not, because it's so common to have someone that will have this kind of background, whether it's what they're coming in for or not, to have that cultural awareness of what they could have experienced can make a difference for whether that survivor is going to continue to reach out for support or not.
I'm wondering also about Australia, New Zealand. There are people who contacted me who said there are a lot of groups in certain areas that can fly under the radar for a very long time. And when you have spaces where there are a lot of hidden spaces and jungles and trees, mountains, or just wide open spaces where people just don't go, where it's just dirt roads, it's very hard to get oversight and for people to or even for neighbors, because there might not be neighbors to see what's going on. So I wonder how much that plays a part here.
It absolutely does. Yeah, that rural landscape and the ability to just exist somewhere for a long period of time and never come on anyone's radar. There are organizations that I can't even call them organizations because they will never register themselves as an organization, like the 2x2s, who exist throughout Australia and New Zealand and are still very much going under the radar. And when survivors are trying to call out the abuse that has happened, they don't exist anywhere. And so it's very hard for anyone to really hold them to account when they are a group that technically doesn't exist, except they absolutely do exist. And then you've got the mainstream churches that have this amazing packaging that look good, that are socially acceptable, but no one's really looking underneath that to see what kind of coercion they're using to grow that fast, to get that big, to stay that big. And so it's both. There are so many cultic groups hiding in plain sight, and there are so many that are just plain hiding.
Mm-hmm. And I think also there is an independent spirit in Australia and New Zealand too. Let's govern ourselves, which I like. And at the same time, it can leave a lot of spaces for people to be going rogue and doing their thing. I'm wondering if you can talk more about what's being put in place now to protect people so that there is more oversight, or at least there's a definition of what makes something unhealthy or what makes it a cult and what's happening in that area.
Yeah, and that's really where this current Victorian inquiry, parliamentary inquiry, comes into it, because the Beyond Belief white paper statement that has been written, which has put a lot of research in, that was written by a group in Australia. I can send you that if you like. But what we are really trying to focus on is the behavior, not the belief. And so what we have really brought into the language here, which is amazing to see it going even outside of this parliamentary inquiry now, is group-based coercive control. So looking at the coercive control that still happens through individuals, but when that happens in a group context, whether that is religious or not religious, that coercive control within a group-based context is different to coercive control that happens in intimate partner violence. And so there are some overlaps, really trying to create this language and this understanding of here are the behaviors that can exist in any high control group that amount to totalistic control. And so we don't want to define what a cult is. We don't want to define what a religious or a non-religious cult is. We want a really clear understanding of what the behaviors are. And I think the Beyond Belief paper has mapped 204 different coercive behaviors and then mapped that to our current legal system to show where the gaps are, that there's actually not enough being done right now to cover this if people were to come forward. And so we're being really mindful to not encroach on religious freedom, but to look at the behaviors that are causing harm.
So important, because the belief sometimes can be the source of the issue, like telling little kids about going to hell and never seeing their family again. That's, in my mind, problematic. And at the same time, right, it really is in the nature of the relationship, how people are treated, the power differential, the deception, so much of it.
Around you sees that. So how is the community around you responding to that? Are they reinforcing it? Are they also reinforcing the fact that you should be keeping yourself under surveillance? And so that belief around, if you don't accept God, then you're going to go to hell and you're going to burn forever. The belief is the tool. The behavior is fear and manipulation. So even being able to bring that back to, even we don't have to look at the belief that's behind that to see that that controlling behavior using fear and manipulation is not okay. So how we're trying to show that this is not about trying to diminish anyone's belief, But no belief should be okay if it is being used as a tool for harm.
And so what is the recourse now that people have? I mean, it really does help when there is legally recognized terminology and you can say, yes, that happened to me. Have there been groups that have dealt with the law where this really has brought people to justice? Because sometimes that takes a turn that is disappointing or it takes much longer than we'd like. But have you noticed in Australia or New Zealand that some people have been able to get justice?
I do know that there are some groups that are working in that space. That's definitely not my field. But I know in New Zealand with Gloria Vale, I'm fairly sure that they've had some wins in court. There's also an organization in Australia called Samson Rising who focus on supporting survivors going through the court system. And it is really treacherous. And this inquiry in Victoria is one of the longest inquiries that we've had. So they are still, the submissions have closed, the initial results have come out from the survey that 217 people did. So that's still continuing. They are due to pass down their findings to Parliament in September this year. And then we will see what happens from there. That's ongoing, but from what I understand, it's the first of its kind in the world. And so hopefully this then creates space for other states or other countries to be able to do something similar. A lot of what we're asking for in this inquiry is that awareness and education and research to be done into this space. There are definitely some more reforms that we're asking for, but the parliamentary committee have been brilliant in looking at the big picture of what do we do, not just when things go wrong, but how can we try and prevent things from getting to that stage?
Right. And so in terms of prevention, I wonder about curriculum. I wonder about children, even college students learning about this. Is that something that is happening?
Yeah, that is absolutely something that has been brought up by every person so far, I think, that's talked to the parliamentary committee. We need this kind of awareness campaigns and education in schools, from primary schools through to universities, where recruitment into different cults is happening at alarming levels. And we found out there are some universities here in Victoria that are already implementing cult awareness strategies and training, so that their students, particularly the international students that come over and are looking for community and are really vulnerable, know what to look for and what are the safe communities, what are the communities that are kind of already approved by the university versus these outside groups that are coming in and trying to push their own agendas. And so that education and awareness is absolutely one of the top things. And education for any kind of professional working in this space, whether that's teachers, counselors, psychologists. So that education and awareness is a huge piece for prevention.
Fantastic. I think what also happens too is there are a lot of people, a lot of organizations that can be registered as religions that are really fraudulent, awful things, and then can hide behind the protections given to religion. And that happened early on in my career when I was working at a place that had been in existence. It's now no longer. It was called the Cult Clinic. It was here in Los Angeles. And I was running a former cult member support group. And there were a few Scientologists who wanted to be a part of it. They wanted to see if any fellow members were in this group so they could really rat them out, you know, report on them. And I thought, why are they telling me right away that they're Scientologists? I mean, they're really blowing their cover so fast. But I realized, because a threat came after, was so that they could cry religious persecution. If I said no, they could say, oh, well, we told her that we were Scientologists, and so that's the reason that she said no. And that was actually one of the reasons, but it was, I need for the people in the group to be safe. This isn't a forum to seek people out and make their lives more miserable for your own gain. That's not why I started this. So it was very interesting that they knew that they could use the legal system in their favor. And that was very frustrating.
Yes, yes, yeah. Scientology is so well known for their use of the legal system. So I'm not surprised at all.
Yeah, yeah.
That's just, yeah, horrible for the people that are trying to find a safe space for themselves. And luckily they found a safe space with you because people could have folded and gone, well, I don't want the legal trouble. Yeah, join the group.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that people know where to reach you and also find out about all of the organizations and the collective and all that's happening and where they can find out about that. But I just wanted to ask if there was anything more that you wanted to share.
No, I think it's just that awareness, even as we both talk in completely different parts of the world, that these patterns exist across denominations and countries and cultures, just to remind people that you didn't fall for it. How could you not? How could you not want belonging and community and everything that they promised? But there is support available to be able to get your own life back.
I love it. Okay, so tell people how to be in touch with you or with the collective or anything else that's happening that you'd like people to know about.
Yeah, so you can get in touch with me either through my Instagram, which is just Elise Heard. That's kind of where I'm most active. And you can find all of my resources on my website, which is eliseheard.com. There's also a link there to the collective. So you can also reach the collective through that page. And they've got a whole lot of different resources, a whole list of books, academic articles, if that's what you're into. We just love that to be a place where hopefully survivors can come and find something that can help them right where they're at.
Nice. And where can people find your book as well?
My book is on Amazon. Holy Hell, Save So Hard, I Needed Therapy. You can get that on Amazon. And that's paperback or ebook.
Perfect. Thank you. It was really, really good to speak with you, to learn from you, to find out about your story of survival, of triumph, of overcoming, and being then a resource to the world. So I really appreciate all the work that you do, and I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Elise. It is really powerful to speak to people like her who have had so many experiences and now has been able to study mental health and be able to really coach people in their lives to help them past their religious trauma. It's really incredibly valuable. And I respect that so much and respect her. Something that she touched on that I want to expand on a little bit is this idea of once you leave, you have to get comfortable with this idea of not knowing, not having all the answers, not having the formula to follow. And this other point that she made about the difficulty with making friends after leaving, this is something I hear about actually daily from people who talk about how they don't know how to do it and they don't know if they should do it or if they're ready to do it. And so I wanted to touch upon some of the challenges that people face just to expand on this a bit so that you don't feel alone if this is something that you're dealing with. I'll be talking more about this in the future to help people get past it. And it will be a bonus episode on Patreon for the Patreon supporters. So please go to Patreon if you want to get a bonus episode like that and any others. There are many tools there in the bonus episodes for people who are in a really lovely way helping to keep the show on the air through Patreon. So one of the things that is a challenge when you have left an organization where you were spiritually abused is that your trust radar is going to be on high alert. Like you've learned the hard way that charm and warmth and shared values can be used as tools rather than them being kind of this lovely connection that's innocent as it should be. And so you have learned to scan for red flags and sometimes to the point where it's hard to relax into an ordinary, even safe connection because you'll feel like you have to assume it's not safe in order to keep yourself safe. And then you second guess your own judgment. So even when somebody seems kind and consistent, a voice inside is going to ask, yeah, but I feel like I must be missing something. Or this self-doubt lingers, like, I don't know if I can fully relax or if I should, because I trusted the wrong people before, and so maybe that's what I'm doing again here. The third thing to deal with is that you confuse safety with distance. Like, if I keep myself isolated, then maybe I'll be safe. Emotional closeness once came with hidden and painful costs. So keeping people at arm's length is going to feel protective, even when it would actually be okay to connect with them, but you just don't know it or trust it yet. And even when you genuinely want connection and are feeling lonely. The fourth point is that you are hypersensitive to power imbalances. Sometimes people don't notice it right away because they're so used to it and they've been conditioned to think that there is supposed to be a power imbalance and they're supposed to be at the short end of the stick of the power imbalance. But for people who really are now hypersensitive to power imbalances, they're going to notice it even in tiny ways, and it's going to be alarming to them. Any hint of someone, let's say, wanting influence over them or is showing them a lot of admiration in a way that feels like love bombing, or they can feel someone trying to control them through maybe charisma or trying to mentor them, it becomes very hard to tolerate and hard to assume that someone might be doing it to be nice, especially if you didn't ask for it and they're jumping in with it. You're going to feel kind of allergic to that. The fifth point is that small disappointments feel disproportionately painful, like a canceled plan or a delayed text or mild inconsistencies. It can reactivate old wounds of betrayal and abandonment, even when the situation could be innocent and benign. The next point, the sixth point, is that you fear being recruited again, kind of emotionally or ideologically. So you might avoid groups, you might avoid communities or causes, shared interest spaces. You are going to worry that belonging itself is dangerous, and like it was before, it's going to turn abusive, or it's going to be filled with demands that it becomes your entire life again. The seventh point is that you struggle with pacing intimacy. Cult relationships often are fast-tracked. They fast-track closeness. So it feels like there's authentic closeness, but it's been manufactured and done very quickly and really intensely. So pacing it becomes something that is very healthy to do, but you don't know what is too fast, what is too slow, or what is just right. You might find that you're worried about sharing anything about yourself, or you might find that you're oversharing because that was the way you connected with people and you're not quite sure how to do it with just the right kind of timing. The eighth point that is important here is that you feel fundamentally different from people you see as quote unquote regular, whatever that means. Your past experiences might feel impossible to explain, leading to a sense of being out of sync or emotionally different than your peers. And number 9 of 10 is that you're wary of people who feel too good. Like if a situation seems really positive or someone's excessively positive, has that sort of toxic positivity, like everything happens for a reason and you're going to make it through and life is going to be wonderful. And I know it and I see it. People who are filled with certainty, people who are filled with confidence. This was once a very seductive thing, but now it might raise alarm bells, even if it's genuine, even if it's really what they see or really how they feel. You're not going to necessarily trust it. That's not a bad thing, because sometimes when people are being that toxically positive, that's not healthy either. But it's good to think maybe this is the way they need to see the world in order to make it through the day. They're not necessarily imposing it on me. And making that kind of distinction, like someone trying to influence me, or are they just letting me know that This is their psychological framework that helps them deal with life. And then the 10th thing is that you might be still grieving the loss of a community while mistrusting the community itself. So you still have this tie, emotional tie and emotional conflict to your past. You may deeply miss the shared meaning and connection or beliefs or belonging while simultaneously feeling the very structures that once provided them were really the source of your pain. And so I think with that, sometimes you might feel like you're not sure if you're ready to move on, or does that mean abandoning the people in your past? And you might still be worried about how those people in your past feel about you. And if they find out that you connected with people who are worldly or who were outside the group, will they judge you? And if you're ever going to be friends again with them, will that be the end of that possibility? There's so much at play here. There's so much that is a challenge that is really important to honor, and it's important to name. If there are other challenges that you've come up against that you want to let us know about, please be in touch. It is always good to hear from you, and I'm happy to hear some other ideas, things that you've come across that have made it hard for you to connect or to stay connected or to be open to connection. Take good care, and I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.